Love Osho podcast brings you the real stories of the people whose lives have been inspired and transformed by Osho. We explore why thousands of people are falling in love with Osho and where to find them. Take a deep breath and enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to the Love Osho podcast. My name is Swaram and I'm the host. Today our guest is Swami Anand Buddha. Buddha was part of the personal security team called the Samurai, a group of men skilled in self-defense and martial arts. Buddha was in charge of the Night Samurai team and lived in close physical proximity to Osho. Buddha is writing a book about his experiences called Sometimes Truth Has to Wait, and aims to bring all Osho lovers closer to one of the most amazing men who walked the earth. Hello, Buddha. Welcome to the Love Osho podcast. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thank you. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
My pleasure. Pleasure is all mine. So I'm so happy to have a chance to talk to you about your journey with Osho. You certainly have an insider look because you lived in Lao Tzu House where Osho lived, and you were responsible for Osho's physical safety, security. So I can't wait to dive in, and I'd love to start by asking you how you came to know about Osho.
Okay. I was living in Ibiza for 13 years, and every year everybody would go to India. I had never been to India, and they would stay there for the winter and come back to Ibiza in the summer. And one year, a good friend of mine, he didn't come back. He stayed for quite a long time. And then when he came back, he was all dressed in orange with a mala. And I looked at him and he was a very close friend. And he looked so much younger and healthier and happier. And I said, "What happened to you?" He said, "Oh, you have to go to India and meet this man." They called him Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. And I said, "Oh, I'm not going to India." He said, "Oh, you got to go. You got to go." So I said, "Yeah, thanks a lot and all, but I'd like to hear more about him," because I was already interested in spirituality. And one evening, he came to my house with a newsletter. Osho used to write a newsletter about once a month. And I read this newsletter, and it just went right to my heart. It was like everything he was saying was just hitting me so strong that when I finished the newsletter, the next day I went to his house and said, "Do you have any more of these?" And he said, "Yes," and gave me about four or five of them. I went home, I read them all. Then I was like very interested. And then he said, "Did you ever hear his voice?" And I said, no, I haven't. He said, "Well, I have a cassette I'm going to bring over, and it's one of his discourses." I said, "Okay." And the lady I was with at the time was cooking dinner, and I put the cassette in the machine. I listened to half of the cassette, and I said, "I'm going to India tomorrow." And it was just like that. It was like such a calling. And the next thing I knew, I was in Pune. It hit me so strong. It was, I could not go. I had to go. And I thought I was just going to go for a week or two. My plan was just to go there for a short time and meet him and experience him. But I fell so in love with him, I stayed.
Okay, so I guess that must have been the late 70s. And then, as you say, you fell in love with Osho and you basically never left. You've been living in the commune for a long time. I'd love to hear your first meeting with Osho in person.
Okay, the first time it was a one-to-one was when I took sannyas. That was January 5th, 1979. And it's strange because when I was a young boy, I used to ride my bicycle through the French Quarter in New Orleans, and they had this antique shop. They had this life-size statue of Buddha, a bronze Buddha. And I would always stop there and just look at this statue and felt so attached and connected with the statue. And then I started reading everything I could find on Buddha, and I started collecting these little miniature Buddhas. So that went on for years and years until when I left Ibiza to go to Pune the first time, I must have had about 50 or 60 Buddhas. So anyway, during the discourse, he told me that my new name would be Swami Anand Buddha. And that kind of blew me away. And I had an incredible darshan with him. He was talking about how Buddha and Jesus and they were awake, and he said there's not much difference between you and them. The only difference is they're awake and you're asleep. And he said, but it's very easy to wake up. You can wake up in a second, or you can take years to wake up. And he just gave me a beautiful, incredible darshan. I loved it. And I walked out of there flying. You know, it was just, that was it. I knew I was going to be there for as long as I could stay. I got a job. My first job was working with a film crew. They were doing some kind of a film work there. And then I did all these groups that he asked me to do. And one day I was called to the office by Lakshmi. Lakshmi was kind of his secretary then. And she said, Bhagwan's forming a security system, and he wants you to be one of his security guards. You'll be one of his personal bodyguards. And if you decide, then he said, you have to be in the ashram most of the time. At least you'll be working 6 hours. You'll be working from 6 at night to 6 in the morning. And you'll have a team of 6 other men. And he wants you to be in charge of the night team, which I never could understand, because all these other guys, Chin and his brother Satch and all the guys that were on the night team, were all full-blown karate. You know, they all had belts, and I didn't have a belt. I was from New Orleans, Ninth Ward. I knew how to fight, but, you know, and I wasn't into karate at all. And one day after I got close to Vivek, I asked Vivek one night, I said, why did he choose me to be in charge of these guys? All of these guys are, like, you know, really good. Dharmendra, one of the guys on my team, was actually studied with Bruce Lee. And they were all incredible, just incredible men. And she said it was because of your maturity. She said you're a lot older than all of them, and they'll listen to you. So that's how I more or less became, you know, in charge of them. I was in charge from 6 at night to 6 in the morning, and then they had another beautiful man named Sattva, who was the day team. He was in charge from 6 in the morning to 6 at night. So we had a 24-hour period that we were, you know, guarding him, more or less. Him and whoever else was living in Laosu, but it was mainly him, of course. And it was an incredible experience. It was one of the most powerful and awakening experiences I've ever had in my whole life. The nights, every night was just magical. I don't know what was going on, but at 12 o'clock, it seemed like, at midnight, it seemed like the ashram got real quiet. And at about 3 in the morning, it shifted into another phase that was, all of the men will tell you the same thing, that were samurai, I'm sure, night samurai for sure. It just went into another phase that was just so incredible. And the first night we were in the garden in Laosu, the next day he sent a message to me that he said, you kept us up. You kept a lot of people up all night last night. And I said, why? He said, everybody was too anxious, too on guard. He said, you have to relax and meditate. So if anything's going to happen to me, all of you will know it at the same time, which I found okay. And I found out later that happened several times, where something happened and we all knew it at the same time. Something he instilled in us that I can't explain how he did it or how it happened, but several times things happened where I went to a certain place because I felt something was strange, and two or three of the other samurai would be there as well. So it was really a magical thing that he did with us. I think all of the Night Samurai and the Day Samurai will tell you the same thing. It was just the most magnificent job in the world. we were very fortunate and blessed to be able to be close to him. He became not only our master, he became more like our friend. You know, it was because we were close to him every day and every night. It was just amazing. Just amazing.
Yes. I mean, sounds a very mystical experience, the way you described it. So basically, if I understand correctly, you're saying that Osho was so sensitive and perceptive that he could feel that you were doing the job, but you were too anxious and stressed. So he was teaching you how to do a job that has a big responsibility, but at the same time, be very relaxed, very aware, without having these jittery thoughts and negative emotions. And then at the same time, in that way, you could be more perceptive to understand it if there was a real danger. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. He said if we were more meditative, we would be much more aware of what was going on. We would all feel it. And it happened several times. It was quite an experience. His awareness was so incredible that you couldn't wear anybody that had close-up darshan, which was the gods, the mediums, people who were working close to him. Couldn't wear any kind of, you know this, I know you couldn't wear any kind of perfume or cologne, or he had a thing about smells, and he had a very strong thing about animal. And I had been, you know, it was about a year or so, I'd been a samurai. And one day some friend of mine sent me a bead from Bali, and a lot of people would restring their malas every now and then. I restrung my mala, and I put this bead right in the nape of my neck, right in the back, where it couldn't really be seen. And one night I was at the Green Curtain, was right in front of his door. That was a seat that you sat in front of his door. It was called the Green Curtain. And he came back from Darshan with Vivek, and he would always stop and namaste me, and he'd say something like, you look like you're losing weight, or you need to sleep a little more, or something, just a little quick chit-chat before he went in. And he looked at me kind of strange. I didn't understand what was going on. And he went in, and within a minute, Vivek came out. She said, Buddha, did you eat eggs today? And I said, no, of course not. You know, we all had to be strict vegetarians. Not everybody in the ashram, but the people who were close to him had to be a strict vegetarian. And I said, of course not. You know, she said, well, something's wrong with you. And I said, no, I'm okay. I'm okay. She said, well, okay. And she went back in the room, came right back out. She says, do you have wool underwear on or anything wool, anything on you? I said, Vivek, you know, we were lovers then. I said, you know, I don't wear underwear. I said, you know, of course not. She said, well, something's wrong with you. And I said, I'm sure I'm okay. She said, take off your clothes. We used to wear these hakamas. All the samurai wore these traditional Japanese hakamas. So I took off my clothes, and I'm standing there naked with just my mala on. And she says, take your mala off. And I took my mala off, and just as I brought it there, we both saw the bead at the same time. And I went, uh-oh. She looked at it. She said, is that ivory? And I went, I'm not sure. I said, but it probably is. It could be. She said, go upstairs now, because I lived right upstairs. She said, and take it off, cut it off your mala. So I did that. But he was not aware that he felt that energy coming from the bead, and knew something was wrong. And that happened several times during the time I was a samurai. Several times I would change the guards in the yard. It was his garden. It was more like a jungle. And now and then I would change some guards around if we felt like we were getting a lot of people were trying to hurt him at the time. It was, you know, they even had $100,000 reward for anyone who killed him. And that was in a newspaper. So they had this one man named Toupee who was going to pay the people to try to hurt him, stop him. And so every now and then when we would hear things, I would sometimes change the guards around. And within 3 minutes, he'd go in his room. Vivek would come out and she said, "Did you move the guards around?" And I said, "Well, yeah." I said, instead of Chin being in Chantazoo, I moved into the Almond Tree and I moved Basant to it. And she said, "Put him back." You know, he said, "They're too close to the window." He was just, you know, so aware of everything that it was just amazing to be around someone who was that aware. He could just see right through you and knew exactly who you were and even what you were thinking, it seems like. But it was quite an experience.
Yeah, I mean, it's very extremely unusual by any standard to hear stories and testimonies of this kind of situations and incidents. To just imagine a man so aware of such small little things that we don't think about in our normal life, day-to-day life. And based on my understanding and what you are saying and the way Osho used to work with the sannyasins, I think it comes down to the fact that his mind was not affected by the chit-chat of the thoughts. And then perhaps that's the key of this complete presence and awareness that you can feel everything that is around you.
Yeah, yeah. He was in total focus of everything around him. Totally. He even knew what people were doing in the ashram. It seemed like he would, every now and then, like one sannyasin would have a disagreement or an argument with their girlfriend. Even little things like that, he would send a message to them. You know, there was one time the food would come in. If I was sitting at Green Curtain, it would have to pass by me to go into his room. And one time the food came in and came right back out. And I told Vivek, I said, what's happening? He said, "There's something funny with the food. You don't feel like eating it tonight." And I said, "Well, you know what it was?" She said, "Yeah, it's something in the chapatis." And we found out that the lady who was making his chapatis had a big fight with her boyfriend. And while she was making the chapatis, she was angry or, you know, not feeling like she usually did. And he picked up on that. You know, every little tiny thing, he was just so amazingly aware that, and there was no doubt, you know, that he was totally enlightened. There was never a doubt. So even from the first moment he spoke to me, I knew, because he would always seem to tell people something about them that no one else knew. It was like your one secret that you had maybe with just your girlfriend or whatever. And he would always mention that while he was giving you, you know, when he was putting the mala on you and telling you what your name was and why he was calling you this name, blah, blah. He was just very, very aware.
Amazing, amazing. Yeah. And then on the other side of the coin, I hear that people who were in close physical proximity to Osho, they could be affected by this lake of silence of consciousness. So did you experience that during your night shift? I'm just picturing you being in Pune in this kind of little garden jungle. It's night, perhaps a full moon. And then there is the presence of this incredible man, completely silent. You know, how was for you compared to your daily activities?
Well, I'll tell you a little quick story. Before he started having all these problems with people wanting to kill him or silence him, he used to have breakfast on what he called the breakfast porch. It was a door that went from his bedroom right out onto a little small porch. And then when all this started happening, it got a little dangerous. So that whole door was sealed up with, you know, block with cement block and repainted. And At first, there was only a few guards he would let sit at this one position, because it was a great position from the breakfast porch. And the first night I sat there, it was around midnight, and I was sitting there and realizing that you had to be very, very quiet when you were there, because you were only maybe a meter from him behind that wall. You were that close to his body. And I started feeling strange, and it was almost like kind of psychedelic. And I was looking at everything, and it was like the leaves and everything, instead of the reflection of the full moon, it was a full moon night, bouncing off of the leaves. It was like the light was coming out of the leaves. It was the strangest thing. And I sat there, and I thought maybe somebody put something in my chai. I didn't know what was going on. I was just feeling so incredible. It got like very, very high. And then the next morning, I was staying on Naylor Road at the time. I wasn't living in the ashram then. I was the samurai, but I wasn't living in the ashram. And the next morning, I was invited to come and live in Lao. Something transpired during that evening. I don't know what, but Shiva woke me up, actually, because at 6 in the morning, I would go back to Naylor Road where I was living, and Shiva came and got me about 9 o'clock in the morning and said, "You have to come to the ashram right away." And I thought something happened to Bhagwan. So I got on the motorcycle with him and we went back, and he brought me right to the office, and I went in the office, and Lakshmi said, "Bhagwan wants to know if you would like to move into Lao Tzu house. And he wants you to think about it for a day and give us, you know, tomorrow, let me know if you want." I said, "I don't have to think about it." I said, "Yes, you know, yes." She said, "Well, that means that you're going to be living in the ashram in Lao Tzu, and you're going to have to be in Lao Tzu most of the time." And I said, "It doesn't matter." So that's how I moved in. But something happened that night. I don't know what it was, but it was just such a magical night. A lot of the samurai have the same kind of story with differently, but that things happened during the night. And I remember Arup told me one night, she used to come and sit on my lap sometimes when I was on the green curtain. And she says, "You guys aren't really protecting Bhagwan." He says, "He knows if something's going to happen." He says, you're his group. We already was doing groups then. He said, you guys are his group. I kind of believe that. It was just amazing. Just amazing. I can't. I'm writing a book actually about it right now, called Sometime Truth Has to Wait. I've been writing it for quite a while, and Damien with the Viha magazine has been after me to finish it. So I started writing again. I hope to finish it, you know, by the end of the year. But I want to put everything. I want people to understand who he really was, because there's so much disinformation out there about him, and he was nothing like what they say in the papers. For instance, one time it was in the Bombay paper that he was in some discotheque, groping some young girls in the back of the discotheque, and that night I was on the green curtain. There's no way he could get out of that room unless he passed, you know, in front of me. And, you know, there was all these stories going around that were untrue, of course. He had a lot of bad press, but anybody who really met him and knew him, you know, knew who he was. You didn't have to be too awake to realize how powerful this man was and who he was and how much love he had. The love he had was just so incredible. And it was so nice to be able to sit there at night, because I was in Darshan almost every night, and to hear the stories and the things he was telling people all the time was just such a blessing. I feel that I such an incredible blessing I had in this lifetime to spend that time with him.
So beautiful. And it really fills me with joy, because this is exactly what I aim to do with this podcast, is to record the stories of people like you who have the inside look and can tell the story of what the vast majority of the people don't know because of the bad press, because of the scandals, controversies, and all the rest. So, well, thank you for that. And I really encourage you to write the book because we need that. So, just for the record, for people who don't know, so Lao Tzu is the house where Osho used to live and few other, not many other close disciples. So you were one of them and you moved and lived there. And what I'd love to hear, even though I'd love to go on and on forever hearing these amazing stories about how Osho's awareness was extraordinary, but also for more historical fact, I was under the impression that the security of Osho was in danger mainly during the time in America, in Rajneeshpuram. Whereas from what I understand, you mentioned a few times that they were already in Pune One, so between 74 and 80, attempts to his life, or, you know, he was in danger. That's why the security team. So can you describe a little bit more some incidents and who was behind these attempts to Osho's life?
Okay. He had one man, his name was Tupai, and he was a very radical Hindu. And Bhagwan had said something one day in discourse, and it started a vendetta between him and Osho. And we had photographs of him at the gate to keep him out of the ashram. But he's the one who, I guess you heard about the time someone threw a knife at him. He was the one who actually threw the knife that day. And it was amazing because some of the samurai were in the audience, and some of us were, you know, Shiva always sat on his left side. I had the opportunity to sit on his right side a few times, and so did Chin and Satch and a few other of the samurai. But as soon as he threw the knife, he was speaking about Jesus. And he stood up and he threw the knife, and it was like almost in slow motion. And Osho, saw the knife coming, and he didn't even stop speaking. He just kept speaking, but he kept his eye on it, and it just passed quite close to him. And so the samurai that were close to him in the auditorium in Buddha Hall got him and brought him outside, and we called the police. And the police came and took him away. He got away. I think he paid him some money, and they let him go right away. But anyway, he sent a note that night from Vivek out to me. I was sitting at the green curtain again, and he wanted me to read the note and to also tell all the rest of the night samurai. He said something to, what happened today was very beautiful, and I want the same thing to happen whenever if they kill me. I want the same thing. I don't want everybody jumping on him and beating him up like mad dogs. Just bring him to the gate and call the police. He said, because if you do that, it'll hurt me worse than the bullet. He thought he was going to be shot, maybe. I don't know. But that's what he said. And but this guy Tupai, he was amazing because he would disguise himself as a woman and different things. And he got in a lot of times. He got in the garden once, in fact. But no one ever got real close to him. We had an Israeli there who, I think he had four or five of his friends there that were actually Israeli commandos. And we asked them for 1 week. Don't tell us when, what night, but for 1 week, we wanted them to, but they called it penetration when somebody got over the fence into the garden. We wanted to make sure that we had our thing together. And we paid them, but we asked them to try to get to his window. And we put a fake gun on the windowsill by his thing. If they got to that gun, that meant that he would have been dead. And no one even got close to it. Never did happen. No, not even close. And they even had an English reporter who came there, and he said something in one of the newspapers in England that Osho was protected as good as a president or a dictator. He said the team that was protecting him was really, you know, gave us a little pat on the back for that. That was nice. He had a lot of people who, I guess, disliked him because he wouldn't hold anything back. He said what he felt. He didn't try to doctor it up or change it. He actually spoke the way he felt. And I remember the night before he left to go to America, Vivek came out and she told me, she said, "We're going to America tomorrow." And I went, "Oh, great." She said, "But you can't come." I said, "What do you mean I can't come?" She said, "Because you had some problems in America before and they want to just go right through customs without any problems. And he wants you to stay here until all the foreigners leave and then come to the ranch." And I told her, I said, "You know, please tell him that if he speaks the way he speaks here in America, they're going to hurt him. They're going to do something. They're going to put him in jail, or they're going to try to do something. They're not going to put up with it like they do here." And she said, "He knows that. You know, he knew it." And sure enough, we see what happened. But he didn't hold anything back. He spoke his what he felt, and it was beautiful to experience all of that. Sure changed my life, I tell you. He never only changed my life, I feel like he saved my life on the path I was on. When I got there, he just completely changed my life. I would have stayed the rest of my life there if he wouldn't have left. I had made up my mind that that was home for me. That was it. There was no other place to go. There was no desire to be with anyone else or see anything else. It was just so amazing to be. I never had keys or money in my pocket. It was just free, you know, to living in Laosu. They took care of all of my laundry and everything. I didn't have to do anything except focus on his safety. That was our only thing, was just to make sure that not just for somebody hurting him, but even for someone making noise when he was resting during the daytime. That was our whole focus, was just to keep him comfortable and safe.
And you did an amazing job on that, for sure.
Yes, we did. He never had any close calls. And he had some incredible men taking care of him, I tell you. Night and day, Summer Riley had some. I had one guy on my team that was just so incredible. We had a fence that was about there was a fence around the ashram, and then in the middle of the ashram there was another gated fence for Laosu house, and there was 21 of us living in the house. And the Laosu gate was about 8 feet tall at least, and there was this one guy, his name was Vasant. He was just an amazing karate person, and he didn't wear shoes. He was barefoot a lot. And he would run. I would be sitting about 6 or 8 feet from the gate. There was one position where you'd sit where it was a little hut where you could see the path that went to Chantasu Auditorium, where they had the darshan every night, and then the road that went around to his car porch to where he lived in the back. So you had a perfect view there of both entrances, and you know, to where he was. And this man would run, and I would just hear the gate, because he would run and he hit the gate with one hand. He would flip over the gate and he would land right at his feet with his hand on my throat. And I never could stop him. He was just unbelievable. But all of the samurai were very well trained and very dedicated. We had something we called the wall, which is and it wasn't just samurai. It was one of his doctors. I think it was one of his doctors and I think two therapists that belonged to the wall. And what the wall was, if someone ever started shooting, we would form a circle around him to keep him from getting hit and get him out. And it was that's how much love there was, you know, for this man. You know, people were willing to take a bullet for him or whatever. So he was very well protected. There was no doubt about that. And he knew that. And he even gave us a little, every now and then in darshan in the morning, he would say things, you know, about us. He said, if ever you see a samurai even beating up somebody, stay out of it. They know what they're doing. Don't ever get involved with it. I know they doing it. It's like me, you know, telling them what to do. So they all know what to do. So just completely stay awake and out of it. So that was, it was just like I keep saying, it's a blessing, an incredible blessing.
Yeah.
I was so sad when he got so sick and came back to India, so sick like that. And that's not been really publicized. And I have to be careful when I write the book how I put that, you know. But and the same with Vivek. I'm sure I knew Vivek pretty well. And I just can't believe that she killed herself. I just can't believe it.
Yes, but, we have a whole episode on Vivek, later known as Nirvana, with Veena, who was her close friend. In episode 60, there is a beautiful testimony of a very close insider look, again, from Veena, who spent a lot of intimate time with Nirvana. And obviously, she gives a totally different view on the story of how then Nirvana lived and died, which has nothing to do with what you mentioned and what many people think.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I could never imagine how doing that.
So you mentioned many times actually Vivek during this interview. And again, for everyone interested to know, Vivek was the closest disciple, very intimate to Osho, the only one who had the privilege to access Osho at virtually any time and lived with Osho. And that's episode 60 with Veena. You were a lover of Nirvana at some point. So is there anything you would like to share about her?
She was the most amazing woman you can imagine. I mean, she was so sweet and honest and loving and everything. She was an amazing, amazing woman. She would bring me Osho sheets and pillowcases when he would like get new ones or change them. She would always bring them up to my room and I would tell her, don't wash them. And I would always sleep on them for about a week before I'd wash them. And he sent me up like the curtains in my room, and he was always sending things to me through her. And she was just an amazing woman. Very bright, very, very dedicated, very dedicated. They had a special thing in the ashram. It sounded like a seagull. And whenever she was not with Bhagwan, he had some issues, some health issues, and he needed her. He could just turn that switch on, and several times we were together, and that sound came off, and she was gone, just ran down to take care of him. And it was also strange because he was such an enlightened being. And then on the other hand, he was just such a normal, regular man. I remember little things like walking him to the dentist and him and Vivek talking about his record player not playing right. Or just little things like that, normal things, you know. So the whole thing was just so balanced, and the love for her and Osho, it couldn't be any more than the way she felt for him and the way he felt for her. He loved her very much, and I'm sure when she passed, it affected a lot of people. It really affected a lot of people. She was a very, very beautiful woman. She even came down to Goa as a time when after everything kind of broke up. I went down to Goa and she appeared at my gate one day, and that was unbelievable because she hardly ever left the ashram. You know, she was always in the ashram, at least maybe not in Lhasa all the time, but she was in the ashram. And I was with this other lady at the time, Mangla, and she came in my room and she said, "Vivek's at the gate." And I said, "Yeah, sure, get out of here." She said, "No, Vivek's at the gate." And I looked and it was Vivek. And we spent the day together. And there was a love affair between us. There was a love affair. She had loved Chin. This was after Chin. But we got pretty close. And she was an amazing woman. Just an amazing woman.
Thank you. Thank you for that. It's always beautiful to give energy to Vivek in this loving, beautiful, positive way. So
when I went to, after all the foreigners left, most of them anyway, I did go to the ranch. And it was really strange because I had a falling out with Sheila. Sheila and I were, when I was moved into Lhasa House, Sheila thought she was going to be moved in because only 21 people could live there. And he took me. I was just some guy from Ibiza, you know. And Sheila had been with him for many years. So I heard that she was like almost packed and ready to move into Lhasa. And he moved me in. And after that, her and I had this thing, and it went on for quite a while. And I was going to make a donation one time. And she said, "Okay, go see Govindo," whoever he was, the guy who was taking care of the finances. And I said, "Okay, I'd like to make a donation." He said, "Okay, where is your money?" I said, "It's in a bank in Switzerland." He said, "Oh, good. Where?" I said, "Geneva." He said, "Okay, we have a bank in Geneva. I'll just give you the name and number, and you can just have your guy in Geneva transfer it to the other bank." And I went back later and he gave me this thing, and it was Sheila Silverman and a numbered account. And I said, "I don't want to give Sheila Silverman, you know, this kind of money. I want to give it to the Rajneesh Foundation or to OJ any kind of way, but I'm not going to do this." So she found out about it, of course, called me back in the office and said, "So you're not going to give the money now?" I said, "I'll give the money, but I'm not going to give it to you. I'm not going to put it into your personal account." And she said, "Oh, good." I said, "You know what that means, huh?" I said, "No." She said, "Well, you won't be in Lhasa long." I said, "Well, if that's what it's all about, you know, it's about the money thing, then it's okay. You know, that's up to Bhagwan." And the next day, I got called back into the office. I went, "Okay, this is it, you know." And she looked down. She wouldn't even look at me. She looked down and she said, "Bhagwan told me to tell you never to bother you again about money or anything." Whoa. So when I got to the ranch, the first day I got there, you had to get in line and sign in to be able to stay there, which I did. And when I got up to the front, in fact, one of the samurais that was on my team, a German samurai, beautiful man, he was about three people in front of me. And when he got there, they told him he couldn't stay. And he came to me and he said, "They won't let me stay, Buddha." I said, "Don't worry." I said, "I'll take care of it." I got there and they told me I couldn't stay. And it was all because of Sheila. There was a lot of people. We saw too much. We did, you know, we did things. And she didn't love the samurai that much, it seemed like. She loved Bhagwan for sure, but she had a thing with a few of us. And that same day, I was on a bulldozer with Shiva. And he told me, he says, "Don't worry." He says, "You don't have to be here." He said, "I don't think I'll be here much longer either. She's going to get rid of me as well." And it was strange because when she was in prison in Portland, I had this strong feeling to go see her, you know, and just sit and talk with her and just visit her. But I never did. I'm sorry I didn't know. But just the way it went, I guess.
Well, it sounds like Sheila didn't like many of the people who were close to Osho.
Exactly.
You know, talking to all the people who were very intimate to Osho, she didn't like anyone. because it was her strategy to isolate Osho and just have this preferential relationship and getting rid of all the most intimate disciples. But look, I'm sure your book is going to be packed of very, very interesting story. I've got lots to say and I can talk to you forever, but we are heading towards the end. I have three final questions for you.
Okay.
So the first one is, what is Osho's greatest contribution to the world?
Wow, that's a hard one. I would say his whole thing was about love, about loving one another. And that was his whole thing, was to bring everybody together, you know, to have everybody in love with each other and doing the right thing. And you see what's going on in politics now and all the things that are happening. And he was totally against that. He wanted to bring everybody together. And it wasn't about him. It wasn't that thing when he didn't do it for himself. He was doing it for the world. His whole mission was for the world. It wasn't about him. I can tell you that.
Okay. So the second one is, what is the most beautiful gift you received from Osho?
I have a ring that he gave me. He gave us everybody, mostly samurai, but a lot of the therapists. He would get things. People would send him things all the time. And he would get the photographer to take a picture of him with it. And then he would give it to Vivek and say, go give this to so-and-so. So I have a beautiful ring he gave me that I treasure. In fact, I promised it to Mitten. I told him when I pass, I left, you know, with Bhavani, my lady, my wife. I said, make sure Mitten gets this ring, you know, and he's all excited to get this ring one day. But that's, for as material things go, I think that's probably one of the precious things. But it was more than that. It was how he changed my life, how he made me see things in a totally different way, and to feel things, and to just become a better person. I think that was the main thing I got that was so precious from him.
Wonderful. So the last question is, you leave the Osho experiment. What does it mean to you personally to be with Osho today?
I wrote a few things for Viha magazine through the years. And one of the things I remember saying, that I love him as much right now as I did when I used to sit at the Green Curtain. That thing, that my love for him hasn't changed at all. It's only grown. It's only gotten better. It's a love like I've never known before. It's not the kind of love you have with a mate or a mother and father or a brother. It's a love that is just so powerful that it's with me all the time. It's like such a precious gift that I have in me. And I'm sure all the people who were close to him, who got to really know him, feel the same way. You know, it was a different kind of love. It was just so incredible that, that's probably the most precious gift, I imagine, is to be loved who I was, just who I was. He loved me just who I was. He didn't want to try to change me, or I don't know how to put it in words. It was just acceptance, total acceptance, I would say. And that has been very precious, and it's really helped me through my life and still does. And I know it'll never change. That will never change.
And I can definitely feel that, you know, it's also very visible looking at the expression of your face. So for all the friends who will only listen the audio, they can hear your voice, they can't see your face, but, you know, your face says it all. You know, it's full of sweetness and love, clearly. Well, that's the end of the show, and I can only thank you so much for sharing your love for Osho, but also for giving us this beautiful view of Osho, combining him as a normal human being, ordinary, but at the same time completely extraordinary, with this incredible awareness and all those incidents that you described that as mundane, but they show that the state of consciousness of this man was completely out of the ordinary. So thank you so much. You know, it's very precious, very valuable, and it's very much in the spirit of what we're trying to do with this podcast. So thank you for being part of the Rav Osho podcast.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Lots of love. Big hug.
Namaste.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it and leave a review. Visit loveosho.com for more episodes, blogs, or to connect with us.